It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at the life of Wisconsin legend, Senator Joe McCarthy.
First, last Friday, Typhoon Haiyan struck the central Philippines, affecting millions and killing thousands of people. It's said to be the deadliest natural disaster in the nation's history.
Countries around the world and organizations have stepped up to help with the emergency response, providing funds, food and water, and medical attention. A lot of individuals around the world have pitched in, and they want to know how they can be the greatest help to the relief process. Here with us to talk about the aid work underway right now is the director of the World Food Program Office in Washington, D.C., John Brouse. John, thanks for joining us.
Rob, thanks for having me on the show.
Can you give us a sense of how the relief is going now, how much food is getting through, and that sort of thing?
I can. You know, if I can frame it for your listeners, they have to consider like Katrina and then Hurricane Sandy just to get an image of how bad this is, and then take it up a notch from there. This is probably the worst storm in recorded history, and so we're dealing with a vast area, hundreds of square miles of damage, and we're building a relief process from there. Right now, we've been able to mobilize emergency relief. We have food on the ground now, and we are reaching people. Yesterday, as an example, we worked together with the Philippine government, and we distributed family packs to about 50,000 people that consisted of some canned goods and then rice. And our goal is to obviously scale that up. We're going to try to reach 2.5 million people for about 6 months, and we're even willing to take it up from there if needs require.
And that I saw on your website, up to 6 months. So this is not something that if there's food supplied for a week or 2 weeks, that's going to do the job. Why so many months?
Rob, this storm flattened a huge area. And as you've seen probably from the pictures in the media, whole towns were flattened, communities were flattened. There's really no infrastructure left, and it's going to take that long to get roads cleared, infrastructure back in place, electricity, water, and then we're going to have to get people back to work as well. We have to help them rebuild their livelihoods, and they can't do that in a week. It's going to take a concerted effort by the international community and the relief agencies, and in particular, of course, the Philippine government, to make this happen.
It seems like one of the biggest challenges in a storm like this is, as you mentioned briefly, the damage to the infrastructure. Even if you get the food ready and available, how hard is it to get it to the people who need it?
That is the key challenge for every aspect of the relief effort. Right now, we have food. The Philippine government has food. We're ready to move it, and we actually have it moving into the area. But then to even get it out of Tacloban, the main town that's been damaged by the storm, it's difficult. There isn't trucking. You have to bring trucks in, which we are doing. We're also bringing in barges and smaller coastal vessels that we can load with relief items and then move around to some of the smaller communities around the various islands.
You're getting it there pretty quickly. Do you just have these emergency supplies on standby in case of a disaster like this, or do you see the storm is about to hit and you gear up quickly? How do you get that response there quickly?
Well, the World Food Program does have a series of humanitarian depots around the world where we store critical items that we can move quickly into disaster zones, and we have mobilized those resources almost entirely. We've drained pretty much everything we have. One particular item that we bring in is a high-energy biscuit, which is a very simple food product that is easy to transport, easy to consume. You don't have to cook it or anything. And you can get those out to tens of thousands of people very quickly. They store for a fairly long time, so they're ideal for this situation.
People often want to know how they can help. I've seen debates online over, should I be giving in-kind donations, food, since people need food, or money so the organizations who know what they're doing can buy the needed supplies. What's the best way for somebody listening to help out?
Well, the best way is really always cash, and that doesn't matter whether you're talking a disaster in the United States or a disaster internationally. It's always the best thing. And in the case of WFP, people can go to our website, wfp.org/typhoon, and you can give through the website. But if you have other organizations that you support, go ahead and support those with cash as well. But if you try to donate anything else, you can imagine it just complicates logistics even further trying to move in other items.
Looking ahead down the road, once the immediate need is gone, as you're still supplying food over 6 months, do you start to help rebuild the food network that was already in place that was destroyed by the storm?
The main job we have is to try to help the communities get back on their feet by giving them stability in the form of food. Generally, the populations themselves get the markets back to work. What we like to do, though, is after a time of giving food commodities to people, there is a point where you need to start putting cash back into the system. So we will undertake a cash for work activities where we will actually pay people to do some of the road clearing, debris clearing activities that benefit their community, but also give them some cash that then they can use to stimulate market development again. So it is very much a part of how we try to structure our responses so that we help the communities at each stage progress back towards normalcy.
In addition to your organization, other organizations around the world, and individual donations, national governments, the United States and others, are getting involved. What kind of commitments have you seen from the international community?
Well, for WFP, the international community has been very supportive, very fast. And in the case of the United States, they've given an overall initial pledge or contribution of $20 million, half of which went to the World Food Program, and we're very, very grateful for that. But if I could add, the other thing the United States has done is it's, of course, mobilized the military. And we work very closely with the U.S. military when it comes to lifting commodities to hard-to-reach areas. And we work extremely closely with USAID and the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance and the Office of Food for Peace. We have a very, very close relationship, and without them, our job would be much, much more difficult.
So I hate to bring up an even worst case scenario. You said a lot of the supplies have been tapped out. They're being dedicated toward the Philippines. How quickly can you gear up for another disaster somewhere else in the world on that scope, or maybe not quite as bad?
No, it's very interesting. When I mentioned the high-energy biscuits to you, we have the factories that we have contracts with. They're gearing up right now. And so we're going to have supplies back in place. The most important thing is that in our humanitarian depots, we have those commodities available to move quickly. You can't produce them at the time of the disaster. You have to have them ready. But now that we know there's a demand, the factories will produce them. And that's the same whether you're talking medical supplies or water and sanitation supplies or any of those things. The international community can produce them. It's having them ready, though, that is the most important thing when a disaster strikes.
John, thanks so much for bringing us up to date. I appreciate it.
Rob, thank you.
That's John Brouse. He's director of the World Food Program's Washington office.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with a look at the life of Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. November 14th is the birthday of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, born in Grand Chute in 1908. More than anyone else, McCarthy is associated with the communist witch hunts that took place in the U.S. in the early 1950s during the depths of the Cold War.
For today's Wisconsin Legends segment, we'll get some insights into the rise and fall of Joe McCarthy. Gerald Podair is with us. He's professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University. Gerald, welcome to the Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be talking with you from Joe McCarthy's hometown.
Right. Well, Joe McCarthy, as we said, he's associated with this intense phase of anti-communism. As he grew up in and around Grand Chute, Wisconsin, how did that shape his politics?
Well, you know, the Grand Chute area, the Appleton area generally, is a culturally conservative area. And that's the environment that Joe grew up in. He is a Catholic, as I said, culturally conservative, a devout Catholic his whole life. And that really shapes, I think, his outlook to the world. He's also a poor boy, and that shapes his populist outlook to the world, or towards the world. So when you combine this cultural conservatism, Joe is a go-getter, is a pull-himself-up-by-the-bootstraps kind of man. When you combine all of that, you have a brew that is conducive to anti-communism once the time comes.
Now, he was only 38 years old. He defeated one of the La Follettes for a seat in the U.S. Senate. Can you tell us something about how he went on to victory in that case?
Well, that's a very interesting campaign. He actually capitalized on Robert La Follette Jr.'s, you know, sometimes we talk about Potomac fever, senators getting Potomac fever, and they start forgetting about where they came from. I think by 1946, that would describe Robert La Follette Jr. He wasn't really in contact all that much with his home state. He was known as a national and even internationally oriented senator. So McCarthy was able to take advantage of that. McCarthy traveled the length of the state, 16, 18-hour days, retail campaigning, made his customary exaggerated charges against La Follette that he was a draft dodger, that he was a millionaire, and was just able to squeak through by about 5,000 votes of out of about 400,000. La Follette also didn't help himself by leaving the Progressive Party, which he had founded in the 1930s with his brother Philip, for the Republican Party, coming back to the Republican Party in 1946. It was a much more conservative organization than the one he had left, and he was almost like a fish out of water. So actually, it's surprising that McCarthy didn't win by more than 5,000 votes under the circumstances.
So he wins this narrow election at a young age, but he quickly emerges as one of the nation's best-known anti-communists. How did that happen?
Well, you know, McCarthy's first couple of years in the Senate were very undistinguished, and in one poll of a national magazine, he was described as the least popular senator in the Senate. In February 1950, however, he capitalized on the emerging anti-communist hysteria in the United States by making a celebrated speech, not in Wisconsin, he made it in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he waved a piece of paper and said, "I hold in my hand the names of 205 state department employees who are known security risks and who are still, even though they are known security risks, working in the State Department." And this was really the signal to begin a rather partisan campaign, not just on the part of McCarthy, but other congressional Republicans, on the Truman administration as being soft on communism.
So about that piece of paper he was waving with all the names on it, I mean, was there anything to that? Where did he get those names?
And as usual with McCarthy, it's murky. When he actually had to introduce a number into the congressional record on the floor of Congress, he chose the number 57. And it's difficult to ascertain where he came up with either 205 or 57. Some people think that he came up with 205 because he had access to a security report from the Secretary of State, Truman's Secretary of State, who had said that, I think he said that we have a report where there are 284 security risks, but 79 of them have been removed. So if you subtract 79 from 284, you have 205. And I think that's where he might have come up with that, except that report was 4 years old by the time he got around to citing it. It was a 1946 report, so it probably wasn't very accurate. Joe McCarthy was a glib, shrewd man, but facts were flexible, were malleable, shall we say.
This was not a one-man crusade in Congress, in the Senate, in the House. Who were some of his key allies?
Well, it's interesting. The Republicans by 1950, the National Republicans, are a party desperate for victory in the presidential race. They have lost five consecutive presidential elections, and most recently in 1948 when they felt they should have won. So they rally around McCarthy, and one of his biggest supporters is a Senate Majority Leader Robert Taft, the dean of Senate Republicans, Mr. Republican, and his support mostly in Congress or in the Senate comes from Midwestern conservative Republicans. William Jenner of Indiana is another name. Carl Mundt of South Dakota is another name. So he's powerful and popular among Senate Republicans because they see McCarthy and McCarthyism as a way to take back the White House.
Now, you said that for Senator McCarthy, facts were flexible. I mean, he had his allies, but he was also politically shrewd. How much did he believe what he was saying? Was it political opportunism or was it more Machiavellian?
Well, my feeling is that his sentiments evolved. In February 1950, when he made that Wheeling speech with the 205 names, I think he was much more of a political opportunist. As time went on, I think he became more and more convinced that there was a grave communist threat in the United States, that there was a espionage problem in the United States, and became much more sincere and convinced that this cause was the correct cause. Now, in some individuals, that might mean that he evolves as a moral human being, as you become more sincere. But for McCarthy, his evolving true anti-communism allowed him basically to suspend the rules of decency, to suspend the rules of morality. That's what a true believer does. When you become a true believer in any cause, rules, laws, morality, that's for other people. You view the nation as in a crisis. And in a crisis, all the rules go out the window. That's where McCarthy was by 1954 when the famous Army McCarthy hearings began.
Let's talk about that hearing and its role in the fall of McCarthy as a prominent national anti-communist figure.
Well, in April 1954, the Senate Committee on Governmental Operations, of which McCarthy was a member, actually began an investigation of McCarthy's charges that the Army was filled with communists, and the Army's charges that McCarthy was harassing them. During these hearings, which lasted until June 1954, there was a bit of comic opera, a bit of drama, but finally, in the end, since these hearings were televised, McCarthy's bullying tactics, cutting witnesses off, making sarcastic remarks, showing a disdain for civil liberties, and finally a disdain for human decency brought him down. Because in the climactic moment of the hearings, the counsel for the Army, the lawyer for the Army, Joseph Welch, made a famous remark. And, of course, in an era of sound bites, this is what you remember. He says to McCarthy, "Have you no decency, sir? At long last, have you no decency?" And that's the remark that we remember the most from those hearings. McCarthy was unable to answer that. It was actually brought about by McCarthy's attempt to smear a lawyer in Welch's law firm as a communist, which Welch thought was a low blow. He protests when McCarthy tries to talk over him. That's when Welch says, "Have you no decency, sir?" And the hearing room erupts in applause, and you can almost see the air or feel the air going out of McCarthy's balloon right there and then. Immediately after the hearings concluded, a motion was made in the Senate to censure him, and in December of 1954, he was one of the very few senators formally condemned, formally censured by the U.S. Senate.
Now, that's one strand of his downfall. What about his appearance with Edward R. Murrow? Did Murrow play a part in breaking him on national TV?
Well, I think he did, because Murrow's two See It Now episodes went on the air right around the time that the Army-McCarthy hearings were about to start. And right before the hearing started in April 1954, McCarthy had a very, very high approval rating in the United States. It was up around 60%. So Murrow taking him on at that time was actually an act of bravery. Murrow, of course, is a very well-respected figure, and I think those shows actually did play a role in starting, at least beginning, McCarthy's downfall. The Army McCarthy hearings did the rest. McCarthy appeared on an episode of See It Now with Murrow and did not distinguish himself. That also was the case as well.
Gerald, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Gerald Podair about Senator Joe McCarthy, who was born this day, November 14th in 1908 in Grand Chute, Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In July of this year, University of Wisconsin System President Kevin Riley announced that he'll be leaving his post at the end of December after 9 years on the job.
President Riley has been with the university since 1996. He served as the UW Extension Chancellor from 2000 till 2004 when he became System President. When he leaves in December, he'll join the American Council on Education and return to teaching part-time.
Kevin Riley joins us now in studio to reflect on his tenure as the University System President. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, you are the second longest-serving president of the UW system. How do you feel about leaving after all that time?
Old. No, I don't. It isn't. I've 9.5 years it will be before I step out in December. So, no, I'm very proud and honored to have had the job. You know, it's one of the great jobs in American higher education. I think, you know, Wisconsin is a small state, relatively poor compared to some other states, and it says a lot about the values of this state that it has been able to build and sustain a wonderful university system, which has done such wonderful things for so many generations of Wisconsinites. And, you know, whenever there are controversies, and there always are, I always find when you scratch down a little bit, people are very, very proud of their university. And the Wisconsin idea, the notion that the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state, I think have made this place feel like it belongs to the people much more than some other universities where I've worked or know.
Now, it's been 9 years. Coming in, did you have a vision, and how did that vision evolve and come to fruition over those 9 years?
Sure. Well, I think the big vision in my time has been, how do we how do we help get more college-educated people into Wisconsin? We know that our percentage of folks with a baccalaureate degree is about 25.5%. The national average, about 27.5%. Minnesota, our nearest neighbor to whom we compare ourselves a lot, is between 32 and 33%. And what you find when you look across the country is the percentage of the population with a college degree tracks almost one-to-one with the average income in the state. And guess what? With Minnesota, 15 or so years ago, we were about even with them in the percentage of college-educated people. They're now 7 or so percentage points ahead of us, and their average income is between $4,000 and $5,000 higher than ours now. That's a trend that we can't allow to continue. So we got together, the chancellors of all of the institutions and I, a number of years ago, and said, how are we going to address this? And we came up with the growth agenda for Wisconsin, which said we are going to add 80,000 additional degree graduates by 2025 beyond those we would normally have gotten. And I'm proud that even through some really tough budget years, we are now on track to do that. I hope we can stay there. We will need some support from the state to do that, to get there. But boy, it's a wise investment when you see that relationship between average income and the percentage of college-educated people.
Now, you mentioned every tenure has controversies. They're always there, ups and downs. You've had a few over the past few years. What do you feel have been the main sticking points when you look back on some of those recent controversies?
Well, I mean, I think one big one really was the debate over whether the system would stay together. Whether the UW campus would split off, have its own board, be a separate entity. And I think that was a tough fight because it was a civil war, and those are always sort of the roughest ones. I'm proud of the way people conducted themselves for the most part through that, believing that we'd have to work as colleagues no matter what the outcome was. It provided an opportunity for the state as a whole, I think, to look at the value of having an integrated system. And the decision finally was there is real value in that, especially when you're trying to produce more graduates, to do more research that translates into jobs and new industries in the state at lower cost. Because by sharing costs, by coordinating programming and research in one system, you have less duplication, you have less administrative overhead. And that the decision was, yeah, that's what we want in the University of Wisconsin.
Now, you were opposed to that splitting off of the UW system satellites. And how do you think, had it gone through, how would that have affected the UW system as we know it?
Well, I think it's likely when you look at other states that have gone through this or have systems structured more in the way we would have been, that we would have had many more out-of-state students in. We would have had higher costs to produce students. We would have had higher administrative costs. We would have had more duplication of degree programs because there wouldn't have been the central coordination through one board of regents in my office.
What about maybe advantages that we passed up in terms of bringing more resources to the UW-Madison in here?
Well, I think we should do that, and we can do that, and we have done that with Madison as part of the system. I mean, it's been in the time that UW-Madison's been part of the system that it's risen to be one of the great international universities. And nobody's a bigger enthusiast about the University of Wisconsin-Madison than I am. That's where, indeed, I'll go back and do my teaching. So everybody wants Madison to do well. The question really was, what was the best model for it to do well and for all the other institutions in the system to thrive with it?
Well, earlier this year, as you well know, an audit revealed that the UW system was holding $648 million in cash reserves, which led to tension with the state legislature. Why was the UW system holding those funds?
Well, yeah, the question always is, with any organization, how much do you need in reserves? If you have none and you have a crisis, then people will say, my God, didn't you have any money in the bank? And now it's disaster that you didn't, because we have nothing to cover these problems. So we were running, 20, close to 25% finally. That was 90 days of operating costs for us on our budget, 3 months of operating costs. We talked about that with the Board of Regents annually. It's in our annual financial report, which was audited by the Legislative Audit Bureau every year. So we thought, okay, people know about this, that's fine. Now, the numbers had gotten high enough, I think, that when some legislators who evidently didn't know about it found out, it became an issue for them, especially around the issue of how do you relate it to tuition. Our assumption was, if you've got the right amount of reserves, you want to keep them, so you don't want to eat them down. So you do need to raise tuition sometimes to deal with the operating costs from year to year. But what we've done is to say, okay, what's the right level now? I mean, we never had a policy before, so we developed with the legislature, with the governor's office, a policy that says if you have below 10%, each campus that has below 10 has to have a plan to get to 10, because below 10 we believe is too low. If you have above 15%, then you need to give us a plan about how you're going to spend that money, so it's just clear to everybody. And that's 15%, I hasten to add, is not intended as a cap, but as a trigger for reporting how you would spend the money. So I think the virtue of this discussion is we'll have some consensus around what it ought to be, and people will know more about how it will be spent in the future. So I think, despite the ruckus, I think, you know, we've landed in a good place, and I think we'll move on.
Looking back, do you think, you know, you've obviously gone in the direction of greater transparency. Was that a miscalculation not to have been more transparent up front way back then?
You can always be more transparent, and more transparency is almost always better than less. I think our assumption was, since in public meetings of the Board of Regents, we talked about these reserves at the levels they were, because they were in our annual financial report, because they were audited by the Legislative Audit Bureau, that financial report was, that was very, very transparent. Now, it turns out, from what we've learned, a lot of the legislatures didn't, despite that auditing, didn't know about it.
I've been reading the papers, of course, and many people have said, you have said, you're not stepping down because of that most recent flap. You know, the timing, people, some people are scratching their heads going, is that enough to, you know, cause him to hang it up and move on? What do you say to that?
Sure. Well, you know, I will have been president for 9.5 years when I stepped down on December 31st. I was the extension chancellor for 4 years before that. So that's 13.5 years in these sort of really public, intense, 24/7 kinds of jobs. That's a big stretch of somebody's life. And I'm not ready to retire by any means, but I am ready to do some other things with my life before I am ready to retire. So the president of the Board of Regents, the vice president, will tell you that I was talking with them well before we had the discussion around the balances about how do we set up a good transition plan so that I could move out in an orderly way and they could do a search and get a good person in. And I think that's exactly what we're doing now.
Now, you talked about weathering controversies. It's part of any tenure. It's what you expect when you do a job that's high profile like this. On the other hand, things have been divisive in Wisconsin. There has been sort of, for a while, I think, kind of unprecedented divisiveness among people in the legislature on all kinds of different levels. You had Act 10, which may have had an impact on the university. How does this fare, like, just on the meter of controversy and kind of uproar? Was this something beyond the pale that you saw, or was this par for the course?
Well, I like to tell my friends who are presidents of public university systems in states that are almost consistently blue or almost consistently red, that their job is easier than when you're in that job in a state that's purple, that flips back and forth, and there are those controversies more often and shifts in control. So I do think it is an easier job if you are in a blue state or a red state. But Wisconsin has been for a while one of those states that flips back and forth politically. And I think part of what people in the public university need to do is to work with the people who win elections and the people they appoint to the Board of Regents. That's just part of the job. If you're not up for that, you shouldn't take the job.
What about Act 10? Now, obviously, this was controversial in the state at large. What about the impact on the university? Was there an impact there? Did it, for instance, affect the university system's ability to attract top talent?
Well, you know, what we said on the issue of unionization was we are neutral as a university, and that really is a matter for our employees to decide what they want to do and try to influence their legislators, the governor, to do what they want to do. And I think that's appropriate because, you know, we had employees and we have stakeholders who were on both sides of that. For the institution to weigh in on either side, I think, would have been wrong.
We're speaking with Kevin Riley, president of the University of Wisconsin System. He's stepping down from that post after 9 years.
And we'd like to hear any questions you might have for President Riley. And what do you want to see for the future of the University of Wisconsin System? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We're speaking with Kevin Riley, president of the University of Wisconsin System. He's leaving that post next month after 9 years.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have questions? What do you want to see for the future of the University of Wisconsin System? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take one of our callers. Next, we have Eric joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I got a quick question. Why is it so difficult to make it, why can't it make it easier to transfer credits from the, you know, the community college like NWTC, you know, those kind of situations, or even from, let's say, La Crosse to Madison? Madison seems like they're all on their own. They won't let any credits in and no transfer credits. I would think if you have a state system, you should be able to transfer credits and make it easier for students to make it cost effective and easier for students to better their education or move from one school to another school.
All right. Gotcha, Eric. Thanks. So what would you say to Eric?
A couple things. It's a good question, and I think it should be easier. And it's something that we have worked a lot on. It is a lot easier now, I can tell you, than it was a number of years ago. And up in his area in Green Bay, we have an innovation there that will help with that called, I like to call it, the upside down degree. So somebody who completes an associate degree at NWTC, Northeast Tech College, not NW, but Northeastern Technical College is up there, can come into UW Green Bay and start as a junior and do his or her general education in the junior and senior year. So most people who go through 4 years at a baccalaureate campus will do their general ed the first 2 years and then do their major. So in these applied degrees, we have the major, in effect, treated as the degree from the technical college, and then you do your general education in the second 2 years to accommodate that that kind of thing. And, you know, we know for a fact, both in Wisconsin and across the nation, many more students who get a baccalaureate degree have credits from more than one institution now. We call it the swirl phenomenon. Students take credits from a variety of different places, and I think it is incumbent on us to make it as easy as possible. Now, having said that, you don't want to give freshman composition credit for a welding course. That would not be appropriate. So there have to be some distinctions made. But within that fairly narrow range, I think there are many, many ways we can continue to improve that transferability.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit about construction. Now, during your tenure, there were more than $3.9 billion worth of projects constructed on UW campuses. And you know, some people look at that construction and say, you know, with tuition and people struggling, the economy struggling, wouldn't we be better off passing savings off to students instead of spending $3.9 billion on construction? How do you justify that?
Well, a couple of things. I think, again, that's a question which is looming larger for us because we have many more ways of delivering higher education now electronically that don't involve as many students having to be in as many buildings for as long as they used to. A thing I would say, though, is a lot of those buildings are constructed with private money. They're money that is given by donors for a naming opportunity on a building. And a lot of parents and students want certain amenities. We're talking about a market and market demand for certain kinds of amenities. And a lot of our campuses are at a point where some of the building stock is getting kind of old and tired, and parents come on and kids, prospective students come on campus and say, "Whoa, I don't like that kind of dorm. You know, we want the dorm that these other places have." So I think we have to look at all of that and say, what's the best way to go? I would expect in the future there will be less need for buildings on campus than there were in the past. And you're talking, of course, not only here about dorms and academic buildings, but research facilities. And there, the more research dollars we attract here, the more research we do, the more the need may be for labs and other kinds of research facilities. So again, you have to look at the whole picture 360.
Let's go to the phones again. Jane is next, calling from Menominee. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Say, well, and I kind of have a unique thing because I'm also a high school counselor, and I push the UW systems a lot because they're great schools. They're
Thank
all
you.
Good. But I can tell you as a parent of one, it's a little frustrating with the nursing situation that's going on in the state. There's a shortage of nurses all over. And my daughter's a sophomore at UW-Milwaukee in the nursing program, and she's worked hard to stay on track to be done in 4 years and took a summer school course. And now she gets to the point where she's going to be a second semester of her sophomore year, and she's going to be applying for clinicals, and they have only 80 spots available for approximately 150 students applying, including they allow students from the technical college in Milwaukee to also apply for these clinical experiences. And from my standpoint, it's very frustrating as a parent of a child who is trying to work hard, and, you know, works as a CNA at a nursing home during breaks and everything else, and then there's no guarantee that she's even going to get into her clinicals for that semester, and then she can reapply, of course, but, you know, what is she supposed to do in that semester, stay in school and have us pay more tuition? So, you know, the demand is there. Kids want to get in that major, and they're being told basically, you know, come to school, stay on track, be on track, and then there's no guarantee. So,
all right. Well, thank you, Jane. What about the bottleneck in the nursing school when there's a demand for nurses?
Well, first of all, good for your daughter for wanting to be a nurse. Good for you for being a high school counselor. I know how hard you folks work with so many students that you have to advise now at the high school level. I don't know the particulars, obviously, of your daughter's situation at UW-Milwaukee other than what you're saying. What I do know is that, you know, we don't in the university control how many clinical placements there are out there. We have to work with the hospitals, the nursing homes, the other places, and there are only so many of those out there at any one time that are willing to do it. I'm sure we would love to have many more of them available so that every semester, everybody who wants one could get placed immediately in it. That's probably just not the fact because they're not all out there. What I can tell you is that we've worked really hard, and I give great credit to our nursing faculty. They were leaders in this. They got together probably 12 years ago now and said, let's do a collaborative nursing program, which we will offer electronically to students all around the state, especially aimed at RNs who are working locally and can't come back, many of them women, many of them women with family responsibilities working out around the state. Let's deliver a baccalaureate degree program, a BSN externally, as it were, using electronic means. And so we have had for 12 or 13 years this collaborative nursing program. Now UW-Milwaukee will also be taking the lead with its nursing program. They'll be one of the first five programs with our new UW Flex option, so that students will be able to earn the Bachelor of Science in Nursing from UW-Milwaukee through a competency-based format. So I hear you. We're working on some of these problems. I think we're out ahead in some ways, but the clinical placements is often one where we just can't create those placements if they're not there.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion lately, to dovetail off Jane's call, and thank you for that call, Jane. A lot of discussion lately about whether it's right to be telling everyone that going to college is the proper thing to do, the thing that's going to pay the highest dividends later in life. The cost can be devastating. The economy isn't necessarily supporting all of these graduates. As UW Systems president, would you still, in good faith, tell students that it's the right thing to do to go to college?
Yes, and here's what I mean. I don't mean by going to college, everybody should come to UW-La Crosse and get a baccalaureate degree. College means more than that. A number of my kids have gone to Madison Area Technical College. Fine. If a student wants to start there, that's great. But get in to the stream as early as you possibly can. We know that your chances of making a decent living if you're an 18-year-old now in the 21st century through a working lifetime is going to be very dependent on your having some kind of post-secondary credential. It's one of the best investments that anybody can make. And for those who are specifically saying you don't need to go to college at all, just go out into the workforce, and some, that might be fine for some kids immediately, but then my guess is 5 years from that decision, they'll be thinking, wow, I'm going to need a higher level credential to go on and earn a decent living. A lot of the people who are saying that, when you look at what their own kids are doing, you find they're enrolled in some pretty high quality colleges.
All right. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here, and good luck with your show. I've been watching it develop with interest.
Appreciate
that.
Or
I should say listening to it develop with interest.
We've been speaking to Kevin Riley, president of the University of Wisconsin System. He'll be leaving that post at the end of December.